comments contained in this podcast do not constitute legal advice. The opinions herein are the opinions of the speakers and not the official opinion of the Hodgson Russ Law Firm. Hey there, tax fans. Welcome to State Tax Talks with me, your host, Joe Tantillo. I'm a tax attorney at the Hodgson Russ Law Firm looking to explore the nuances of state and local tax law. Here on the show, our goal is to keep tax informative, simple, and fun. So if you're ready to talk tax, turn up the volume and dive into this episode of State Tax Talks. I'm joined today by Chris Doyle, who is at this point a friend of the pod and a welcome guest. And we are also joined by a first-time panelist on the pod, Mr. Mario Cato, who is an associate in the state and local tax group, along with myself at Hodgson Russ. So welcome, Chris. And for the first time, welcome, Mario.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Today, we are going to be discussing the tax provisions of interest in the fiscal year 2024 budget bill for New York State. This is something that we like to monitor at Hodgson Russ every year to make sure that there are no surprises for taxpayers out there and, you know, helps keep ourselves up to date as well on you know, potential changes to the tax law. Chris, why don't you tell the listeners at home a little bit about the electoral process for, you know, how a bill becomes a law, you know, the schoolhouse rock version.
So insofar as the budget goes, it's not a proposal from the legislature. The initial proposal comes from the governor's office. The governor sits down with the tax folks and her budget director, and they come up with proposals both for spending and for revenue. We care not so much about the spending stuff. We don't work with that. We care about the revenue stuff. Process-wise, the governor is required by, I think, the state constitution to propose her budget in writing every, third Thursday of January, because the fiscal year starts April 1. So it gives them 2.5 months to actually work their way through it. This year, the budget was proposed by the governor on February 1st, which is allowed because it is the year following an election year. I should say following that, there is a 30-day period for amendments. I don't know that there was a 30-day amendment of note issued this year. And then it is not uncommon for both the state Senate and the state assembly to issue their standalone budget bills so people can, you know, argue about, you know, what to keep in the final bill that is supposed to be voted on and enacted prior to April 1. We're already hearing rumors that that won't happen.
Thanks for that explanation, Chris. And at the moment, as you alluded to, the bill is currently in the pending stage of legislation. As of time of recording, the Senate is looking at it, the New York State Senate, that is. But as you said moments ago, we anticipate that it will pass without any major amendments. So we are going to dive into the substance of this piece of legislation without further ado. So the first thing we're going to talk about, and something that popped out to us as significant, is a provision in the legislation that gets at state and federal S-corporation conformity. And Mario, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about that piece?
Yeah, so this part of the bill would require all federal S-corporations to be treated as S-corporations for New York purposes, unless the corporation is a qualified New York manufacturer and chooses a New York C-corporation status. So Chris, maybe talk about maybe what some of the practical implications of that part of the bill will be.
Sure. One of the really interesting and good provisions in New York's law is that New York taxpayers can choose to not adopt flow-through entity taxation for federal S corporations. There is a separate New York S election that's required now. So you can, for instance, be a federal S corporation and get flow-through treatment federally, but not get flow-through treatment for New York. And that can be good because the nominal tax rate for corporations is lower than most of the upper brackets of New York's personal income tax. So there's a tax rate benefit. Plus, if all of your shareholders are residents, they pay tax on 100% of their income. Corporations pay tax only on an apportioned amount of income. So you could end up having, you know, significant savings there. The tax department doesn't like it because they view anytime there's an election, taxpayers will elect to adopt the strategy that produces the least amount of tax, right? So the state views it as being a revenue loser. And it also has some complexity. It adds complexity to the law that, you know, might not otherwise be there if everything was conformed.
I think one of the interesting things about this provision is from the research that I've done, it seems like this is bringing New York State into line with what a lot of other state legislatures have already done. It seems that, generally speaking, there's automatic conformity between state-level S-corps and federal S-corps. Would you agree?
Yes. And in New Jersey, for instance, another state in which we practice, they just adopted legislatively conformity, but they give you an opt-out. So you can opt out instead of opting in. In New York, you've got to opt in. Look, it is true that this would conform New York to the majority of states, but it's a taxpayer benefit. Like the way it is now is a taxpayer benefit, and they're choosing to take that benefit away if it gets passed.
Well, and, you know, not surprising that New York is doing something with this legislation that isn't the most taxpayer friendly, not something we haven't seen before.
Sure.
Another provision of interest, or should I say provisions of interest, is that there were a number of extensions of various credit provisions throughout the revenue bill this year, which is something that we saw as well in prior years. So Mario is going to note a couple of the more interesting ones for you now.
Yeah, so a couple of these credits that have been extended or slightly modified are the COVID-19 capital cost tax credit program, the Empire State Commercial Production Tax Credit, the Heating Oil Conversion Tax Credit, and then another one worth noting is the Brownfield Redevelopment Tax Credit.
And we do a lot of Brownfield tax credit work in-house. Joe Endres is our local expert on that. And that, I think, is going to be sort of a major fix in addition to extending the credit. They made a technical change that changed the period for which you could get credits from 8 years from the date of the issuance of the certificate of completion instead of 8 years from the date of entry into the program. So that will extend the practical benefit for several more years, I think.
I think another interesting one that was extended is the Historic Property Rehabilitation Tax Credit, which is utilized by numerous property developers throughout the state. Next, let's talk about the new tax on cigarette and tobacco products, or rather the rate increase, I should say.
Yeah, so this part of the proposed bill is going to be an increase to the state excise tax on cigarettes. So the current excise tax rate on a package of 20 cigarettes sold in New York State is $4.35. So here the bill would increase the rate by a dollar for an excise tax rate of $5.35 for each package of 30 cigarettes. It would also increase the existing use tax rate on cigarettes by a dollar as well.
This is a classic example to me of New York legislating public policy through taxation.
Yes, which is a horrible idea.
Oh, it's an awful idea.
You know, if you want to make it illegal, you should just make it illegal. But I think New York it has bought into the power to tax is the power to destroy. And I think when they identify things that they want to destroy, they just tax them out of existence. And I think that this is, they clearly don't like cigarettes. And not for nothing, New York State probably agrees that the social cost and the actual healthcare cost that the state has to bear as a result of cigarettes is unacceptably high as a policy matter. But using tax policy to get rid of cigarette smokers is, I think, it's a very dull scalpel to be using in that particular operating area.
Yeah, I mean, I think to the extent that you wanted to have any like real impact on controlling whether people are going to buy them, you would have to actually tax people out of, you know, affordability. And right. I don't think a $5.35 excise tax is going to do the job. I'm going to guess that smokers are still going to smoke after this rate increase.
Haters are going to hate, smokers are going to smoke.
And but that's got to be part of their reasoning for the increased tax. So they know smokers are going to smoke. So at what point is it less of a
policy reason of, you know, making it harder for smokers to get tobacco and more of just a money grab from the tax department.
But because it's only a temporary money grab, though, I think mm-hmm. that there are projections that show that eventually, you know, a couple, not even 5 years down the road, but like 2 years down the road, it results in less people smoking. So less people will pay the tax and buy cigarettes and pay the tax.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think the difference you see from something like this, as opposed to like the cannabis taxes that are going to be happening or that are happening. You're the cannabis tax practice person.
I operate in that area as well. And there is a proposal to simplify cannabis taxes because apparently they're too confusing for people that are actually buying cannabis.
No comment.
Well, currently the structure is it's a potency-based tax, which is a tax on the THC content of the products that you're buying, which I kind of like because it takes away any sort of tax incentive to buy gummies instead of to buy flower, right? So that from a purist standpoint makes sense to me. But I agree, it's far more complicated than it needs to be, and it minimizes the need for a whole new testing industry. Yes, you have to test for THC content, but now it's not a tax issue. It's just a packaging issue. That's not part of the budget, by the way.
No, that's not part of the budget.
Separate proposal. We're taping this on March 8th, 2023. I think that Crystal Peoples Stokes and some other legislator announced that they were going to do that either early this week or late last week, that they were making that proposal.
One other thing that we should note about the cigarette and tobacco issue is that the budget actually amends the tax law to allow the Department of Taxation and Finance to impose certain penalties for cigarette and tobacco retailers who refuse to comply with regulatory inspections and investigations into whether they are actually authorized retailers and collecting and remitting tax and all that good stuff. So
since I'm here to add color, I remember I was a two-pack a day guy way back when.
Really?
Back when I smoked two packs a day, you could buy them at a vending machine in my favorite bar, and they were 65 cents a pack.
Wow.
That
is that back when they marketed cigarettes just directly towards children?
No. No, well, yes. I think now I didn't realize it then, but I didn't smoke Camels. Like, I was, you know, Joe Camel didn't turn me on, nor did the Marlboro Man.
Mario and I grew up in the era of vaping, which turns out is like just as, if not worse for kids, because, I mean, talk about something that was marketed directly towards kids. Like, oh, just come and suck on this cotton candy nicotine for,
Don't look at a cigarette, but here's a electronic version of one that is, you know, 10 ways worse for you in some ways.
Way more addicting, and I would never, ever want to smoke one right now.
This is a good time to announce our new podcast on FDA issues related to, you know, marijuana, cigarette smoking, and vaping.
We must have attorneys in the firm who deal with all that good stuff, regulatory stuff.
Sure.
Yeah.
Of course we do.
But not us.
But not us, no. We just care about the money.
So what we're going to discuss next is something that is a bit more dry, however, a very necessary technical change to the pass-through entity tax laws. I'm going to turn it over to Chris to explain this one because essentially the law as written up until and when this change passes basically created a circular loop of logic where you were having some deduction issues that didn't necessarily give you the intended benefit of the pass-through entity tax.
And the fix here, I'll describe the fix first. The fix here is to define pass-through entity taxable income upon which the pass-through entity tax is based on federal taxable income prior to reduction by the pass-through entity tax itself. And of course, the whole point of the pass-through entity tax is to give you the pass-through entity owner a deduction for pass-through entity taxes that you can deduct for federal tax purposes. But if you deduct the pass-through entity tax deduction from your federal taxable income, and the amount of the pass-through entity tax is based on federal taxable income after the pass-through entity tax deduction, you've got a snake that's eating its tail, right? You keep on spiraling the tax deduction downward because you keep spiraling the tax base downward. And this would take care of that problem.
Myself, Chris, and one of the other attorneys in our group, Liz Pascal, spent about an hour poring over the tax code prior to this revision, trying to figure out what the right answer was on this issue of interpretation.
Yeah, and I think that actually we gave the advice to accountants to do it exactly the way the legislature proposes to do it, which is ignore the pass-through entity tax deduction for purposes of calculating the pass-through entity taxable income base.
So I'd like to think that we made this change happen.
Right.
By complaining that it was not clear, which is really just what lawyers do, isn't it? They complain that something's not clear so we can get our way.
Sure.
Chris, one for you here that I know you're excited about, the business income tax rate extension.
Sure. Right now, actually in 2015, the tax rate on entire net income was scheduled to be reduced until it got all the way down to 6.5%. It should have already gotten there, but the tax rate reduction on entire net income has been deferred a couple times. And honestly, I can't get real upset about the deferral of the tax rate reduction. What does bother me is that also something that was supposed to disappear is the capital base tax, which is a tax on the net worth of the business. It, admittedly, it's at a very low rate, but if you have a terrible year in the business cycle, you still have to pay that tax. Mm. And indeed, that's its point. If you have a bad year in the business cycle where you've got no income, you actually experience a loss, this capital base is imposed so that you always pay a tax. And I understand its necessity for balancing the budget from time to time, but it's really confusing. It adds like 8 pages to the tax return. It's just an annoyance. And my guess is that it probably costs more to administer the tax in the form of, you know, cost to train auditors in this oddball tax and the necessity to have special computer programs to actually make sure that the right amount of tax is paid on the return than it actually brings in as far as revenue goes.
And that provision is extended through 2026. So instead of sunsetting at the end of this year, we've got another 3 years of having to deal with that complexity.
Right.
Minimum, right?
Right. And I think that provision was supposed to sort of kick in like 2018 or after 2018. So it's been that can has been kicked down the road a long way.
Yeah, so don't be surprised if, 300 episodes from now, we're telling you that it's being kicked down to 2050.
Right, and again, the rate freeze doesn't bother me so much, but the capital-based tax is a constant nuisance.
Let's wrap up the discussion of the provisions proposed in this specific piece of legislation with some of the changes, or rather, one specific change made to the MCTMT, or the Metropolitan Commuter Transportation Mobility Tax. There was a provision that, in air quotes, which you can't see, but I promise you it's happening, clarified the treatment of limited partners for the purpose of the MCTMT.
Yeah, so this part of the bill would amend the definition of net earnings from self-employment in the tax law to clarify, like what Joe just said, the treatment of limited partners. So here it's going to provide that only true limited partners are not subject to the MCTMT, while partners who take part in the management or operations of the partnership remain subject to the provisions.
So let's take a step back and talk about what the MCTMT is. It is a tax on employers downstate, so in the 7-county MCTD region where there's, you know, huge public transportation. So it's where the subways are. It's where the New York City buses run. That 7-county region has a lot of need for revenue because of the public transportation. And this is viewed as necessary to keep the public transit MCTD, the Metropolitan Commuter Transportation District, in the black instead of in the red. That is sort of the deep background. The critical comments I would have is, number one, it's not a clarification, it's a law change. the tax itself is based, it depends on whether you're an employer or a self-employed individual. If you're an employer, the tax is based on the amount of wages you pay to people that work in the MCTD. If you're self-employed, like a partner in a partnership or a proprietor in a proprietorship, the tax is based on your self-employment compensation. And that is a defined term, not in New York law, but in federal law. So the Internal Revenue Code governs what is self-employment compensation. And right now, specifically, there is excluded from self-employment compensation amounts paid to a limited partner. So the change that they propose here is not a clarification. It's a law change. And when they use the clarification, it indicates to me an intention that they want to apply it retroactively. And by the way, our office has handled cases where New York has attempted to apply this proposal just using the commissioner's discretion.
Yeah, I think the lack of clarification, to use the legislature's own term, against them regarding whether this is going to apply retroactively is one of the things that set off the largest alarm bells for me personally, because you have potential exposure for a lot of taxpayers who, you know, reasonably relied on the law as written for all the tax years and were, you know, lawfully not paying tax under the law.
Yes, the good news is if you did reasonably rely on what the law said instead of what New York wishes the law said, this clarification, I'm pretty confident you'd be able to get it overturned with respect to you if you reasonably relied on the law by going to court and saying, like, this is just wrong. The law said this. I cannot now fix, you know, the change in the law. I cannot now change my conduct to reduce this new tax that you've imposed on me. It's unfair, and there's due process litigation out there on that very issue that will, you know, you can use to cite to perhaps get that particular provision abated as it applies to you.
Nobody likes certainly tax attorneys don't like retroactive tax law changes.
No. No more than taxpayers.
Yeah.
So when we see kind of a proposal get labeled as a quote-unquote clarification, is that kind of the telltale sign that the tax department's thinking about applying it retroactively?
Yes. So technical corrections or clarifications, often they have retroactive effect. Here, it says it's effective immediately. Normally, a clarification will say it's effective immediately and it's applicable to all open tax years. The fact that they didn't put that in there suggests to me that there'd be an argument if they tried to apply it on a backward-looking basis. But I know the tax department, you know, give them an inch and they'll, you know, try to drive a truck through it.
And then a separate bill is actually adjusting the MCTMT rates as well.
So a related provision of a different bill would propose to increase the rate of the MCTMT from 0.34% to 0.50% for employers with quarterly payrolls over $437,500 and from 0.42% to 0.50% for taxpayers with MCTD source earnings from self-employment.
You know, if they need the money, then they can get reelected after imposing a tax increase, more power to them.
Yeah, this one, other than just the fact that I don't like tax increases in general, isn't particularly bothersome the way the clarification was bothersome to me.
No, and equalizing the rate applicable to employers and self-employed people, I never understood why there was a difference in the rate in the first place. So equalizing the rate makes sense to me. I have to say, though, with respect to employers, this is like a 30% increase, right? Going from 0.34% to 0.5% is a 30, you know, it's like a 1/3 increase.
Yeah.
That's a big jump.
It's significant for sure. And people are going to feel it in their pocketbooks.
Right. So the power to tax is the power to destroy. What's going to happen to those people that are currently working in New York City or anywhere in the 7-county metropolitan commuter transportation district that are now, you know, now if you work outside of the state or in the state but outside of the MCTD, your employer doesn't have to pay that tax. And, you know, you can probably guess that certain employers that employ a lot of people are going to think, well, here is a half percent tax on compensation that I don't have to pay if I start putting people in Buffalo.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So you think about, you know, Citigroup, they got a lot of people in Buffalo. There are a lot of employers that are in New York City that have back office operations in Buffalo or Albany or Schenectady or Rochester or Syracuse. Yeah. And, you know, if you think about where they're going to invest, they're not going to invest where they've got to pay that extra half percent tax. They're going to invest in other locations.
I think it's common sense. I think the tax department would probably disagree because they constantly seem to disagree with us just about people making moves based on tax legislation right. in general, which is astounding. But I think you're right. You know,
the governor agrees.
Yes. That brings us to the conclusion of our examination of this specific piece of legislation and some of the more interesting tax provisions that are in it. If you would like to read a more full analysis, a more detailed analysis, rather, of all of the changes, including a number of miscellaneous provisions, you can find our alert on the Hodgson Russ website titled Tax Provisions of Interest for Fiscal Year 2023-2024. But there are some other floating propositions that I think are probably more interesting and a bit scarier out there for the average listener and the average New York taxpayer. And this is a phenomenon of proposed legislation that is occurring not just in New York, though we are going to focus on New York in a second, but all over the country. And that is the proposition of wealth taxes, taxes on the ultra rich and taxes on your net assets, basically. Tim Noonan and I wrote a blog post back in December called a Blue Wave of High Tax Rates, where we took a look at some of the referendum votes that were happening in California, et cetera, this past election cycle in November, and how this is becoming a more regular occurrence where these proposals are making it further and further. And we have yet to see a state really implement one of these wealth taxes, but it's got people nervous.
Yes. So the power to tax is the power to destroy, and one has to think that if a state starts taxing wealth or starts taxing capital gains on a discriminatory basis or starts taxing what the beneficiaries of estates or the estates on a discriminatory basis, those people will just leave. People that anticipate getting that kind of income or having wealth, they will just go someplace that does not impose a tax on those items. In New York, because, you know, the progressive elements, and by the way, I'm apolitical, because the progressive elements are feeling empowered right now, and I think that they've got good reason for feeling that way, they are making proposals to get more revenue. They just want more revenue so they can do more spending on what they think is are good and meritorious spending initiatives. The taxes that they are proposing are increased income taxes, and this is just in New York. So they are going to create 10 new tax brackets for people that are in the top 5% of earning capacity in New York State. Power to tax is the power to destroy. Where do you think that 5% is going to go?
Well, I can tell you based on, you know, literally everything I've spent the last 3 days at work on is that they're getting out of New York. I mean, it's they're just not going to hang around. You don't have to work in this field of law or even as a tax professional for long to know that if you push people's buttons with a high enough tax rate and aggressive enough tax department, that they are just going to make a change, because there are states and state legislatures who are aware of what's happening in a lot of northern states or a lot of Democratic-leaning state legislatures that are proposing these kinds of increased tax brackets, these kinds of potential wealth taxes, and they're taking advantage of that opportunity. And they're saying, come to our state where there is no state income tax.
Sure.
And people are taking them up on it.
And it's not just the legislatures that are doing it. Massachusetts just, you know, enacted a 10% plus tax on the, you know, millionaire level and above. Mm-hmm. And that was done by referendum.
Right.
Although the people just got together and said, well, let's just tax these people. And as a consequence, we're doing more residency work in Massachusetts now. So it is driving people. Maybe the evidence is anecdotal, but man, there's a lot of anecdote in our office right now.
And I cannot say I get it in terms of being able to exactly step in the shoes of these taxpayers, because I don't make $25 million a year. If I did, I would do this podcast full time, my one true passion. But, you know, a lot of people suggest that, you know, the idea behind this piece is that people who are making that much money can afford to pay the taxes, but which may be true, but that doesn't make it easier for someone to swallow a $3 million annual tax bill to the state. Like, that's still, it's $3 million, regardless of whether you made 25. That's a lot of money.
Right. Look, they can afford it.
Yeah.
Well, like all of our clients can afford it.
Sure.
But they can also leave.
Yeah.
Like who
and it's
who
cheaper has more, to leave.
Right. Who has more? You're right. If for $3 million, you could buy a nice house someplace else that won't tax that stuff.
Yeah. Even in Palm Beach.
Right. So some of the other proposals that are being out there, and these are actual bills in print, because the federal government gives a preference for long-term capital gains. They're, you know, taxed at a rate in the 20s, the low 20s, instead of a rate in the high 30s. New York State proposes to tax that rate difference. So if you have capital gains, even though in New York there is no capital gains preference, everybody pays at the same rate depending on what your bracket is, or I should say all income is taxed at the same rate depending on what your bracket is. New York wants to discriminatorily tax capital gains because the federal government isn't taxing them enough in New York's mind. So they're going to take that 18% difference in federal tax and apply it at the state level and confiscate your money that way. I think that that's a really dangerous thing. New York has proposed, or certain people in New York, legislators have proposed an heirs tax. So it's not enough that you have an estate tax. What if somebody who has an estate that matures lives in Florida? Like they figured it out, I can't pay the estate tax in New York, it's too expensive, so I'm going to move to Florida so I can die there. Well, if that happens and your heirs are still in New York wants to tax your heirs because they couldn't tax the estate. So that's a proposal. Another tax is what they've called the billionaire's tax, and that's a mark-to-market tax, which taxes you depending on the value of your assets at the end of every year. So in a good year, if the value of your assets go up, New York wants to tax you on the difference as if that difference was income.
Yeah, that to me is the one that is, and again, some listeners might say, but the billionaires can afford it. Of course they can. But let me ask you a question. How on earth is the tax department even going to enforce this? The level of audit training that you would need to do a constant annual audit of the entire net worth of a billionaire and the calculation of what the assets are worth and the growth and in the ways that that could be manipulated. I mean, sure, you can do it, but it's going to be a real big pain to do it year on year. And people are just going to leave before they even get to that point.
Right.
Because they're not going to want to go through it.
Right. You know, you're going to have to turn every auditor into a valuation expert. Now, of course, if all you have is a portfolio of marketable securities, the valuation is easy.
Sure.
Right? But if you own an interest in a hedge fund, that valuation is much more difficult. You might get a statement at the end of the year telling you what your value is, or you might not. And if you own a closely held business, wow. Or a farm, wow. How are they going to figure that out? Or commercial real estate.
Yeah.
Or, how are you going to figure that out?
The billionaires that have a little bit of all of that.
Right.
You know, which is not uncommon. That is not an uncommon portfolio of holdings for someone who is worth $1 billion+ to have.
Or they can, they can just move down the road a little bit and they don't have to worry about it at all.
Right. So very unenforceable at times, but also just from the state's perspective, it seems like they're thinking a little short term. So they're bringing in all these taxes. But, we pass around an article probably once a week in the office saying like, hey, look at all these people moving from New York to Florida or another low tax state or no tax state. So are they just not taking into consideration just the long-term effect of these increased wealth taxes?
As far as I can tell, and I haven't been doing this long enough to give, a 10-year view on this, but it does seem like the state doesn't really believe that people are actually leaving. Like, my understanding is when it's been raised to them, the issue that people are leaving because the taxes are too high, they've kind of said, no, that's anecdotal.
Right. Except for the governor. The governor says, no, they're really leaving.
Yeah.
And we have to be careful not to have them leave because 20% of them pay 80% of the personal income tax revenue in the state.
Which, just say that one more time, 20% of them pay 80% of the personal income tax revenue in the state. These are colossal numbers. Like, New York cannot afford to lose these people.
And I don't know what the exact numbers are, but like the top like 4% pay maybe 50% of the personal income tax revenue in the state. Those are the people, and again, those are the people that have the easiest time leaving.
I think New York would have an easier time just trying to attract all the altruistic billionaires to come and live here, like the people who, like, there's, go get Bill Gates to move to New York. He's constantly giving away his fortune.
Sure.
You know? Because the ones that are here, you pass something like this, and they're probably going to be gone 6 months down the road.
Actually, the one I think you want is Melinda Gates.
Yes, Melinda is probably the most altruistic.
Right.
Is she still at billionaire status, or has she given away too much of her fortune?
Know.
Oh, well, I think this is a good place to bring the conversation to a close. Chris, Mario, thank you both for joining me. We will probably put out an update on our website once the bill actually becomes finalized and is signed into law by the governor. So keep an eye out for that if you are curious. Otherwise, stay tuned and, you know, follow, subscribe, give us a 5-star review, all the good things that help us get this podcast out there. And we can keep spreading the good word of tax updates to all of those listeners out there.
Yeah. And before we sign off, you mentioned that we have our clients and friends letters and our alerts on budget issues on our website, but we should note our website is www.hodgsonruss.com.
Yes. Yes. I think it's in the bumper too. So you're going to get hit with it twice. All right, listeners, thanks for joining us for another episode of State Tax Talks. If you're interested in listening to more episodes, we're available on all platforms where podcasts can be found, including YouTube. If you enjoyed this episode of State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo, please give us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast platform. And if you're in need of a tax professional, you can contact the tax attorneys at Hodgson Russ. Go to www.hodgsonruss.com for more information. And until next time, I'm Joe Tantillo, and this is State Tax Talks. Catch you later, tax fans. The comments contained in this podcast do not constitute legal advice. The opinions herein are the opinions of the speakers and not the official opinion of the Hodgson Russ Law Firm.